Thank you for the February 2019.
Mr. Speaker, when a person who has served this nation in this place passes, it is incumbent on us, however long ago he may have graced this chamber with his presence, to remember what it is that his contribution was to the development of our country. This week we had over the weekend the sad news of the passing of Aurelio Monterito, a man who, in the time that I have been politically conscious, after he had retired, was well known to all in Gibraltar of his generation as the first Gibraltarian Minister for Health. And in the tributes that I have read, written of those who shared time with him in this Parliament and the memory shared of his time in the Parliament, he's not just a man who was Minister for Health, he's also a man who was very highly regarded across the community, even across the political divide. And I think it's fair to say that you were his closest political colleague still in this House, but the Fellow of the House is not with us this afternoon, and has had fond memories to recall also of Aurelio Monterito, although he sat opposite him in this House. You will make your own tribute, and you have already said something, Mr. Speaker, that indicates the affection that you had for Mr. Monterito and the regard you had for his political ability. From this side of the House, on behalf, no doubt, of the whole community and of the whole of this House, our condolences go to his family. It is true, Mr. Speaker, that we all build on the work that those who have come before us have done. In the context of somebody who passes away at the age of 97, I'm left to reflect that this is a man from my own father's generation. Of the Gibraltarians who were in Gibraltar before the war, and when the war came, they were not taken from Gibraltar, they remained in Gibraltar to defend Gibraltar. And from their efforts before the war, they started to build, as we saw the return of the Gibraltarians to Gibraltar, a community that would become an nation. We owe them that forever.
The Honourable Member of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, there is little that I can say about the late Aurelio Monterito, CD, former Minister for Medical and Health Services, and former Deputy Minister. That has not already been said by those who knew him well or had the opportunity to engage with him. It would be an eloquent of me to reflect on a life of contribution and achievement in relation to matters which took place long before I was born, and where so many in our community have contributed to numerous eulogies and reflections of one of Gibraltar's sons. In our quest to learn more about Aurelio's contributions to this House, I discovered that not only was he a man of deep conviction and faith, he was a staunch defender of Gibraltar. Aurelio's family had rightly and importantly, while traditional and social media reflected on his full life, lived well. It does, however, fall on me in my contribution to ensure on this side of the House that the Parliament reflects on Aurelio's life and his contribution to our political development and opportunity. I will simply refer to his journey of passing in what he stood for, his values, and his deep faith. I never knew Aurelio, but I suspect that I have missed out on not knowing him. In my research and looking into some of our old handcards, I noticed from Thursday, the 30th of October 1969, Aurelio made a passionate contribution to the then constituted House of Assembly on a motion brought before this House on the subject of initiating talks between the government of Gibraltar and the British government on the question of UK citizenship. Aurelio said, "We, as I said before, have agreed very forcibly with the rest of the members of this House, and I am sure with the rest of Gibraltar that Gibraltarians have a right not only because of the situation prevailing in Gibraltar, not only because of the 2.4 square miles, but because, Mr. Speaker, we have thrown in our lot with Britain too. We have done our part in the referendum, therefore, sir, we must initiate these talks. Not a struggle, struggling for something, even a concession. It is something we are entitled to. We have not only thrown in our lot with Britain, but we share our land with Britain. We give her facilities of a base, we give her our workers to help in those facilities, and if I may say, on percent, the sweat and labour of our workers at not a very high price, because we all know, too well, we have been through the struggle. So, sir, we must initiate these talks with the understanding that we are going to fight and fight all the way. Mr. Speaker, in my further research, I discovered that this was a very good question in the House of Assembly, as it was then, and as he was then an opposition member, was in relation to the provision of people, provision for people with mental health issues. That, to me, revealed much about the man and his ability to navigate Gibraltar internationally and on the domestic agenda. It is impressive to note that we as a community are rightly putting much emphasis now on mental health, which for many has been a taboo for many, many years. And understanding our earlier concerns that provision in 1969 demonstrates his commitment to the health of our community and to tackle an important issue. Mr. Speaker, I could go on about our earlier contribution to this House, but I have hopefully made out two examples which demonstrate his strong defence of our community and his empathy on important domestic issues such as mental health. Aurelio was clearly a politician of his time, and although political flags move in the wind, Aurelio's values and what he stood for stand the test of time. I do like to think that the same inbuilt humanity and passion and drive for bettering our community exists in this House today as it did in Aurelio's time. Aurelio does, I think, represent a political class which the current crop of politicians on both sides of this House have much to learn from. Gibraltar, indeed, is a different place to when Aurelio was a politician. Our challenges are different and in many ways are more complex and are the product of an evolution of our community. But we can learn many lessons from our forefathers. It is important to ensure that our young people, Mr. Speaker, know about the political journey, not only of our community, but of those individuals who are pivotal in the development. And one suggestion I would have to the government is trying to make politics more accessible to young people by looking at the personalities behind the politics and make it easy for our young people to digest them and identify the struggle that I've earlier described in his contribution, for example, to the UK citizenship debate in 1969. In celebrating the life of Aurelio, we celebrate Gibraltar. In celebrating Aurelio's political achievements, we celebrate Gibraltar. They go hand in hand. It is right that Aurelio's children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren celebrate a life well lived as a family and record his contribution to public life in this way. I would like to express on behalf of the Members of the List not only our condolences to the family, but also our genuine and sincere gratitude for sharing a significant part of Aurelio's life with his family.
Mr. Speaker, when I heard about Elementary Group's passing in the early hours of Sunday morning, I felt like I had lost another piece of my father. Because since leaving my father at the tender age of 21, I'm hearing the stories of the development of our nation ever since from his peers and contemporaries. I learned how crucial members of his political family had been to him, both politically and personally. And actually, Mr. Speaker, our Elementary Report was one of my father's closest political and personal allies during his long and substantial political journey. Mr. Speaker, our Elementary Report is the last of the AACR founder members to leave us. The end of an era, one could say. An era of men and women of pure conviction, seven at a time when there was no precedent or template to follow. A time when foundations were being laid and existential battles were being fought. Our Elementary Report was one of our pioneers, our defenders, our forefathers, and therefore we as a society must reflect on this and make known our eternal gratitude to him for securing our democratic platform that we take for granted today. As Deputy Chief Minister, he offered to Gibraltar Hassan an invaluable and solid co-stewardship of our community at a time when my father would so often feel isolated and shunned by the external forces trying to play a part in our destiny. In those days, Mr. Speaker, it was all about purpose. Today, there is intrigue, intel, hearsay, technology, self-interest, and a barrage of factors, including apparently even the Russians, Mr. Speaker, that influence and play with our decision-making processes. In those days, Mr. Speaker, it was about conviction, conviction, and more conviction. This, Mr. Speaker, is one of those things in life that binds us all. It knows no parties, it knows no sides. It's the one portfolio that we are all invested in. Other portfolios can benefit many or a few, but health is the one issue that we all depend on, and that elementary people have the foresight to understand the magnitude of delivering this essential service to our citizens and to our society at a time when Gibraltar was far from being the wealthy state that it is today. I really have the vision to provide Gibraltar with the first primary care centre known then, and even still by many, known today as the Health Centre, as well as to extend a much-needed section to the original St. Bernard Hospital. These accomplishments will certainly enhance the quality of life and even the life expectancy of so many of our citizens at the time, because of course it follows that having a dedicated health centre and better facilities at our hospital would have translated to an overall better and more sophisticated level of general health care in our community. And for this, we have our elementary for to thank, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, my father always used to tell me that we have to hope to get lucky, not just in life, but also even in death. And our elementary people didn't have an untimely or painful death. Last Sunday, Mr. Speaker, our elementary people had peacefully died in his sleep, had lived for almost 10 decades, and had been a pivotal part of a collective that shaped our democracy in the harshest times of our political history. I really died a committed husband and father of six on the 18th of February of 2018, leaving 18 grandchildren and 18 great-grandchildren. It was incredible to see that the number 18 was all around that area, Mr. Speaker, because a religious, God-fearing Christian like him might have known that in the Old Testament, the numerical value in Hebrew 18 translates to the word God and life, and is time and time again associated with luck, health, positivity, and fruitfulness. Mr. Speaker, just like the number 18, our element of Hebrew was all of these things, and equally we, as a society, have indeed been unlucky as a number 18 to have had this exceptional man in the front line shaping our political development to the proud nation that we are today. Thank you.
I was a person who actually met our own Barisa in the old days of the Gibraltar Evening Post when I was still a child. And then I think he has shown and his political trajectory shows that he's one of those historical or political figures of Gibraltar, somebody who, like many others, were born in the heyday of the AACR and the Catholic Church in that political organization, and indeed who participated actively in the political and constitutional changes which followed very rapidly since the end of the Second World War. So the City Council, the Legislative Council, and later on the House of Assembly. So I think one thing which people will know about them, those in England, is a very human approach to politics. And that sense of humanity, sadly, sometimes is lacking in politics in general. But at the age of 97, I think that people will agree how the country is perhaps a good inning. And that certainly we have noted back in the political and constitutional development of Gibraltar. So I pay my own condolences to his family.
Next, the Honourable Robin Jenner.
Mr. Speaker, I did not have the privilege of knowing Mr. Aurelio Barroso
nevertheless, I am acquainted with many of his descendants, some of who are here today and others who are not here. And what is definitely true from his life is that you know more about the person when they pass away, and that's sad, about the legacy that they leave than when they have been alive. And obviously that is as a result of the age gap between some political politicians who are here today and when he was serving. Nevertheless, Mr. Speaker, what I have learned this week from the late Aurelio Nicolito is what a genuine person and loving person he was, as much as he cared for his family, but also the deep respect he had within his faith. I would like to pass my condolences officially to the family who are here today and represented, and obviously join and echo what has been said already from members in this house contributing to his career.
Mr. Speaker, I too unfortunately never met Aurelio, and the House has discussed already the many excellent attributes he had as a politician and as a family man, and therefore there's very little for me to add except to say that many of the foundations that we take for granted today in our health services were in fact laid by Aurelio. One of them is Manon Hassan has spoken about the fact that he started the health centre and indeed he inaugurated it in June of 1973. And all of us today we take for granted the fact that we have an outstanding primary care centre and that, as the Honourable Lady has said, health is one of those issues that touches all of us at one time or another in our community. But it is not only the health centre which Aurelio envisaged and which he inaugurated. To his credit, he also started another foundational block of the health service, which is the GPMS scheme. And that also occurred during his tenure, so that we have a system whereby we are prescribed medicines in that health service, and that was all down to the act which he enacted as Minister for Health in 1974. So, in two consecutive years, primary health centre and the GPMS, again, another foundational block of the health system, which we all take for granted today, but which I think the record of this house reflects is found and due to the vision of Aurelio Montegrifo. But, Mr. Speaker, there is also yet another revolutionary foundation block which he also instigated, which is the Sponsored Patients Programme, which he started in 1974 during his tenure as Minister for Health. So my predecessor, Dr. John Godbert, and myself have to thank him for having laid those foundational blocks which have allowed all of us today to receive the health care free at the point of delivery, which we take for granted, but which we all, I think, must agree must pay tribute to his efforts, to his vision, and for laying those foundations which provide today the health system that we have today. So I wish to associate myself with all of the words that have been spoken here in the memory of Aurelio Montegrifo and to pay my condolences to his family.
Dr. John Cortez,
I have very, very little to add to all the things that have been said here today, except for one thing. Being, I think, the oldest elected member present here today, I did know Aurelio Montegrifo. He was a close friend of my late father, and his name was very often mentioned at home, and I remember visiting his office on more than one occasion with my father when I was a child. What I want to say, Mr. Speaker, is nothing more than this. Everything that everybody here in this chamber has said about him, the people who did not meet him, I can confirm is absolutely true.
This is one of the numbers. Just struck me for the first time. But the fact that I haven't received a mail today, I probably always say what I want to read for. So, when you have an anybody else, was the person that opened the door to my leading from central politics into Gibraltar politics back in 1963. I first came across the Willie Montegrifo when I was about 20 years old. And my family moved to Willie's Road, and we moved a couple of stairs below Aurelio Verde and his own really growing family. And then in 1963, when I returned from university, it was he who, for him, that I was invited to join the executive committee of the OEC. And then, of course, in 1972, we both came into government when we defeated the intervention of the Britain Party in 1972. And then, I already paid tribute to his qualities as a journalist and as a politician. A man of great ideas and commitment. His ideas, as part of the philosophy of the ANCR, his ideas of Gibraltarianization, that the Gibraltarians were a fit and proper people to take over the management and the running of Gibraltar. His commitment and nurturing of the campaign as a position to the right to allow Gibraltar to the Gibraltarians. These are matters which he always pursued most ably in the column of the Gibraltar Evening Post. And then, I think it grew and developed from 63 onward and throughout the last 6 decades. I could share many similar hopes and ideals. Another thing that happened in 1972 was that my brother in law, my wife, brother in law, Aurelia's only daughter. And they are our neighbors. And so we feel, my wife and I, we feel part. And that is the same family that I want to leave us here today. And finally, as I said, going back over the 6 decades, I share very many happy memories of our lady, and we rest in peace. Therefore, that makes Willis's Road a place which has had one chief minister and two deputy chief ministers, like one of Arista Road has had. Not that that is relevant in any way, but it is relevant to say that the fulsome gratitude that has been expressed here today to Mr. Montegrifo for his contribution and to his family is a reflection of the character of the man and of the love that Gibraltar has for this particular servant. And if I could just then, for one moment, reflect that. The New People, which is not a newspaper that has been known for its praise of the record of the AACR, or indeed of those representatives in such a kind, a very fulsome obituary, a very generous obituary of the man, which I think recognizes that affection across the political divide that must be a characteristic that we must seek to carry forward. And today, Mr. Speaker, as we turn to debate and we characterize each other and let them perhaps as friendly terms as we might, we must bear that in mind as we go forward. So, Mr. Speaker, I'd like to thank all honourable members for the contributions they have made in this House to reflect the contribution of Montegrifo and see the power that the Montegrifo ASEAN partnership had brought before this House before, and hope we never see one again.
Thank you, Mr. Byrne. A bill passed to amend the Pensions Act and Pensions Regulations. The Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill for an act to amend the Pensions and Pensions Regulations be read a first time.
I want to put the question, which is whether Bill Sinai Act and then the Pensions Act and Pensions Regulation be read the first time. All in favor? Against? Carried. The Pensions Amendment Act 2018.
I'm going to move the bill being read a second time. The bill which amends the Pensions Act and the Pensions Regulation. The bill gives effect to the agreement entered into by the Secretary, which will go to Port Authority and unite the Union to make Port Officers an essential service akin to fire, prison, police, and customs officers, that I would commence from the 1st of April 2016. Port Officers of a Marine grade, with the exception of the Captain of the Port, who were transferred from service under the government to the Port Authority, and to whom the pension that applies will receive all the benefits attributed to essential services. This includes officers receiving a pension rate of 2/600 of his pensionable emolument, between his 20th and 27th year of service as a court officer, in accordance with Regulation 4.1 of the Pensions Regulation, commonly referred to as the doubling up rate. Furthermore, like the other essential services, court officers will have their compulsory retirement age set at 55 years. Those measures will begin to apply to all court officers as from the 1st of January 2018. Officers who retired between the 1st of April 2016 and the 1st of January 2018 are entitled to similar benefits in accordance with the terms of the Early Exit Scheme Agreement approved by the Financial Secretary. Like other essential services, court officers will benefit from not paying tax on their pensions from the age of 55. This will be implemented by way of amendments to the Income Tax Allowances, Deductions and Exemptions Rules 1992. There will also be moving amendments to the bill at committee stage. An amendment is required to change the year cited in Clause 1 of the bill, because the Act will now be known as the Pensions Amendment Act 2018 when it becomes an Act. And a third amendment is required to give this bill retrospective effect from the 1st of January 2018, which is the date when the provisions were meant to apply to all court officers. But this bill has now passed, amendments to Clause 3.4 are required, and Clause 4.3 can be deleted in its entirety. Lastly, amendments have been made to remove the Assistant Chief Fire Officer and the Deputy Commissioner of Police from the definitions of Fire Officer and Police Officer, respectively, so that only the heads of departments are excluded from the definition. In any event, the two posts that have been removed from the definitions actually no longer exist. I therefore commend the bill to the House.
Before I put the question, there's only one member which is to on the general principles and merits of this bill.
I will now put the question, which is whether Bill Sinai Act to amend the Pensions Act and Pensions Regulations be voted a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Pensions Amendment Act 2016.
I vote to the notice that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today?
The final motion of the House is so that it falls into committee. Would you please move that the House before we can?
Mr. Speaker, I'm going to move that the House would resolve itself into committee to consider the following bill, clause by clause, namely the Pensions Amendment Act, or the Pensions Amendment Bill 2016.
Bill passed to amend the Pensions Act and Pensions Regulation. Paragraph 1 amended. Second part of the bill. Clause 2 amended, second part of the bill. Clause 3 amended, second part of the bill. Clause 4 amended, second part of the bill. Long title, second part of the bill.
I have the honour to report that the Pensions Amendment Bill 2016 has been considered in committee and agreed to with amendments, and I now move that it be read a third time and passed.
I will now put a question, which is,
that a brief is not from independence or contention to relation, be here by first time. Those in favor? Or together? Carried.
The amendment to government motion, the other, the deputy chief minister.
Yes, the Honourable Dr. Bertha Gresham.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. I have the honour to move the motion standing in my name, which is as follows. This House requires the establishment of a select committee from the UK and the Virgin Departure from the European Union, known as Brexit. The very word of the PYN and the NLN of the Advocate Number 6 of that committee. It's sort of the motion is set to stand and propose to have anything further to it.
I have proposed the question in return to the motion moved by the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, it is unfortunate the government rationale for altering the composition of the Brexit Select Committee has not been fully explained to members on this side of the House. The British Social Democrats is the only political party represented on this side of the House. We occupy 5 out of the 7 seats. All 7 members on this side of the House participated in the 2015 general election under the same PSD banner and supported our programme for government. Our community decided that we should form an anti-loyal opposition, and we are proud to serve our community in opposition and aspire with the support of our community to be governed to vote. It is a great privilege, Mr. Speaker, and responsibility to serve our community in the role of opposition, and we do so with pride and respect. Mr. Speaker, opposition is not easy. It requires us to hold the government to account, and we are required to change their decisions and robustly test their policies. There is a time when the greater good and the public interest of our community means that we must put aside our differences, swallow our pride, and do what is right for the wider and sometimes unseen interests of Gibraltar as a whole. My colleagues in and outside this space will always put Gibraltar first. The decision of the UK to leave the EU is not one that we as a community shared or agreed with, but it is one which we must accept. The world does not stop turning, and we must get under the job we have been elected to do. We must ensure that Gibraltar continues to succeed in the context of international challenges to our way of life. Gibraltar will survive. There is no question that we will overcome the challenges Brexit presents to us. I, for one, although disappointed that we are being dragged through this process, see it as an opportunity for us to refocus on the domestic agenda and our people. Of course, no one doubts that the government should be doing everything it can to ensure Gibraltar's survival, but we must not forget the people who we do this work for. We cannot forget those in whose name we act for in and outside this place. There are people with real concerns about education, health, housing, and skills training, to name a few. We will support the government on areas of common interest and put Gibraltar first. However, we cannot support the government on a motion when there are domestically playing party politics in relation to the composition of this important committee. It is clear to us that despite what anyone says, they will force this issue in without any real analysis and without any explanation. I know that members are fond of comparing us to the UK, from waiting numbers at hospitals to education, and that then perhaps they should look at how select committees are comprised in the UK. It is guide to select committees published on the UK Parliament website. The principle is that the membership of committees reflects the party balance in the House as a whole, meaning that a majority of each commissioner will be on MPs from governing party or parties. I remind the House that it was under the principle that composition should reflect the composition in this House, that the government brought a motion establishing the Brexit Committee in the first place, in August 2016. And it was on this basis that we supported the August 2016 motion. In fact, Mr. Speaker, it was the Honourable Chief Minister, when bringing the August 2016 motion, who recited the following: believes that the composition of the Select Committee should reflect the composition of the House. in the debate on the motion of the 7th of October, it was the Honourable Chief Minister himself who made the following observations on composition of the present committee. Namely, Mr. Speaker, quoting Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister, the one thing that I think is important is that I explain why the composition would be 4-2-1. In the context of select committees, the government will always have an in-built majority. And in order to ensure that the committee stays nimble and small enough, the only way that we would be able to have an in-built majority, if it were bigger, would be to have 5 members of the government, 3 opposition, 3 members of the opposition, and the Honourable Lady, because we think the Honourable Lady, as an independent parliamentarian, should be represented in that select committee. That would mean that the parliament would be meeting with almost half its members in select committee. There would be 8 of us. So in order to keep it nimble and try and reflect the members' opposite, the only way we can do it is to do 3, therefore 4 on our side, if the Honourable Lady is going to be 1 on the other side. Of course, the other way to do it is to keep it 4 on our side, the Honourable Lady, and just 1 of the members representing the party opposite. We thought that would be less representative. So that is why we are proposing 4-2-1, to keep it nimble in that way. Mr. Speaker, it is on this basis that I wrote the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister in response to his motion, trying to support this house, changing the composition of the basis of the committee and consistent with ensuring that committees are nimble, that the candidate composition remains, or that should, in addition, we know that the official opposition should also be provided for a form for a further 4 seats in that form. We note this point as the only opposition party and the members who hold the majority on this side of the House. And it is our view that should properly be reflected in the select committee of this House, as has always been the case. To try to construct this in any other way is an attempt to eliminate and denigrate our contribution as the elected official opposition of Gibraltar. It is not right, and it reflects very badly on the GSOP Liberal government's supposed democratic credentials. It is telling that both the select committees on parliamentary reform and constitutional reform have not sat 2 years since they were sanctioned by the House. It is a shameful reflection of its purported support for democratic reform. We also suggest that the government, consistent with further observations by the Chief Minister of the previous debate, could at any stage brief other members of Parliament at any stage. The Honourable Chief Minister will recall at page 26 of the debate on the 2016 motion that he himself said that Honourable Members should know that we do not advise, that we do intend to advise them, even without the select committee, about such aspects of the discussion and negotiation. Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister went on to cement what he was saying by saying that the Honourable Members should be briefed. They will be. Select committee or no select committee. Mr. Speaker, what are we doing here? To the attack. 1. The official opposition has 5 out of 7 members on the side of the House, and over 5,000 people voted for us to be in this House. We are the majority and the only opposition party in this House. The Chief Minister is on record of having stated the select committee composition for the select parliament composition. 3. The Chief Minister on record has stated that the independent having the 7 members of the official opposition would be less representative. Fourthly, Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister on record has stated that he could utilize briefings to members of this House, select committee or no select committee. Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister's first change of position on all 4 points back to playing party politics with the most important duty and responsibility that he is charged with, namely safely navigating the Gibraltar's exit from the European Union. I call on him to abandon the motion on the standing order 22, which has little to do with protecting our community and more to do with him and his present crusade against the opposition.
Well, did it keep going,
Mr. Speaker, the Hitler is to say, I have just heard the Honourable, the subordinate to the leader of the party that is the official opposition, namely the leader of the opposition, and back upon to seek to exclude an independent member of this parliament from a select committee of the House. I think it is probably the only time in the history of democracy in the world that the opposition has argued, and opposition has argued, for less involvement from members of opposition benches in the work of a parliament. And it couldn't happen in a dictatorship, because in a dictatorship the government is the one that is excluding the opposition. But in this democratic society in which we operate, in these
complex and difficult time, the government is seeking to include more members of the opposition benches in the determinative work that we're doing in respect of the future relationship that we will have with the European Union. And the leader of the official opposition, not even the leader of the opposition, the leader of the official opposition, makes an argument to keep fellow parliamentarians out of the committee process. Because he says, we can brief them anyway. Of course we can brief them anyway. But the select committee is about briefing, coming as in truth. It is about making decisions together when the time comes. And that is why the other Mr. Lennox knows that we and I sometimes have very big disagreements. We probably have many more disagreements than we have agreements. In this select committee, you must come in to disagree with us. Because we don't know what happens in the committee, because we don't know what the benefit to the select committee yet. But we think we should be there. How can it be right to try as parliamentarians, forget the fact that we sit on this side of the house as government and basically on the side of that part of the house over there as members of a fraction of the system? How can it be right to try to exclude a parliamentarian for the select committee process? I would have thought the argument was to include more parliamentarians in the process. But of course, we have no parliament, and we have to be careful not to find ourselves in a situation where the whole parliament is sitting as a select committee of the parliament. But Mr. Speaker, we have to have an inbuilt majority in a committee where we're going to make decisions. We owe that to the result of the last general election, and we feel it is right, proper, and appropriate to include independent members in that decision making process. Now, Mr. Speaker, we have been accused of many things unfairly, but never. Never, Mr. Speaker, with the lack of political logic that Labour members have for what he has got up and said in the fight. Mr. Speaker, I hope he is fast receiving lots of messages from his leader outside this place to try and get an angry message going forward into. Because it is impossible now, Mr. Speaker, in the future, for Labour members to say anything that will restore any democratic legitimacy to any argument we can ever make. It is absolutely impossible. And let us look at the type of contradiction that the Honourable Member has brought to this house. So, being leader of the official opposition and before the leadership of the opposition, to get into the logic of what he says now. The Honourable Member has said to us, alongside his former leader, when we were facing the results of the referendum, that the government should step back on everything and concentrate just on Brexit. Today, Mr. Speaker, saying that Brexit should not stop us from continuing our national political agenda. That is the sort of black and white thing that the Honourable Gentleman will say, and not even black, can go from black to white without going red. It's really quite incredible, Mr. Speaker. It is going to be this community deserves better. It deserves a better and more mature political debate in these difficult and challenging times than a supportive defender of the parliament going out to seek to exclude a fellow parliamentarian from an opportunity to discuss and debate the future of this community before a committee. Mr. Speaker, I don't think if you were seeking to do petty partisan politics, you would be excluding parliamentarians who represent independent views from a process of debate. If you were trying to do petty partisan politics, you wouldn't have included any of the independents in the select committee. Now, if you were saying, well, your opposition, you've got two, we've got three, let's get on with it quickly. Absolutely the opposite of what the Honourable Gentleman has said that we are actually seeking to do. Because it is obvious, the Honourable Gentleman said we've got 5,000 votes. Well, it is obvious that the 5,000 votes were not for him, Mr. Speaker. The imagination had been for the person who at least had the gumption to leave the party at the election. I hope that he's not claiming those votes. The person who now leads the party, who wasn't even a member of the party at the time that they got those 5,000 votes. But those 5,000 votes, Mr. Speaker, when you say, "Never been to the other lady," you can stick them in the other thing of those 5,000 votes. That means that the speaker, in any democracy, is the second biggest vote winner on the other side of the speaker. Nothing, Mr. Speaker. And the other gentleman may have just been the 17th member to collect their list of votes elected, but he's nonetheless an important part of the three elected offices. Except that he's no longer a member of that team. But he's also entitled to claim the credit for his vote. Those are the people that he represents now. We run the party system. But the other gentleman may wish to reflect upon the fact that each of us has been elected individually with the vote individually of members of the community. And the other people on that, or am I disagreeing with what he said, or have done with those rights of representation that those votes give him, could be elected with a large share of their votes. I can't actually remember the numbers. I think it was just 18 more than somebody who thought that they would have been set, but it was more than the person who came 18, Mr. Speaker. Right? And therefore, Mr. Speaker, an argument that seeks to exclude somebody like that from the position advanced by the government, which is an inclusive one, is not an argument that can be said to be based on any attempt to extend democratic legitimacy in a representative democracy like ours. Now, Mr. Speaker, I said all the things that the gentleman has read from himself about being nimble with the situation that I was presented with. I said, Mr. Speaker, that the spectrum of the official opposition, as much as it has started up to now, means that we are less nimble. We were dealing with one party first, and there was another government on this side, Mr. Speaker, with two parties, but acting as one government. So, one and one. 70% one and two. Now it's one and one and one, Mr. Speaker. We find ourselves, Mr. Speaker, with three oppositions. When it comes to education, we deal with all of them separately, some of them together, one of them which is really a nightmare for the government. In the old days, I almost saw most notable gentlemen in his aggressive questions. There was one coming and one back, one coming and one back. Now there's three coming, there's going to be three back. This is a reality that the great people of the community is in our community. But to say that we need to pander to that breakup and that we have to ignore the fact that there are others who have different views on something that's fundamental, versus the really fancy, does not accept it. Mr. Speaker, but we have to be seen how the leader of the party opposite, not in Parliament, has sought to change the way that the rules on broadcasting should be changed as a result of the circumstances in which they have put themselves. Well, Mr. Speaker, that was right and not agreed to by the DRA. We understand the unanimous response of everyone who wasn't in the DAC who was asked for a point of view, Mr. Speaker. I seem to recall that that was the view expressed by Mr. Warner. And I wonder, Mr. Speaker, whether the very unparliamentary and contra-democratic approach taken by the Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition today is not a vindictive attempt to convict Mr. Lama for the responsibility to the Gibraltar Regulatory Authority on the attempt by the leader of the GOC to try and change those rules. But Mr. Speaker, all of the answers are the way that we have to address each other. The Honourable Mr. Phillips is today in Parliament, although not the leader of the GOC, the leader of the official opposition. And there are others in opposition. And we will make a decision in the British Select Committee about things we may put to the Parliament, Mr. Speaker, and we will make it with the official opposition and with the independents who also represent the voice of the community in however small a way, however difficult we have to be about it in other instances, but it is absolutely right that they should form part of that decision-making process. And that's why, Mr. Speaker, the motion brought by the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister and my full support, and it will, of course, enjoy the support of the government, Mr. Speaker, is something that we considered in Cabinet, Mr. Speaker, and it is a motion which Honourable members may expect to see rolled out in respect of the other is due, so that the select committee decisions made in respect of those other matters are also truly representative and inclusive of the views, even if I disagree with them, of honourable members who represent independent opinions in this House. And if I may say so, Mr. Speaker, I am grateful to the Honourable Leader of the Official Opposition for the way that he has represented the view he has expressed in this House today, because never again in any debate will honourable members be able to claim the mantle of democratic legitimacy and their indeed, Mr. Speaker, to pretend that they are truly parliamentarians at heart. What they represent is an attempt to use this place for their own ends. They demonstrated it when they were in government, and they used that power of the executive always to get away with it, and they thought, Mr. Speaker, they'd be able to get away with it in opposition to it and exclude independent members. They've fallen apart already on laws too, Mr. Speaker. I wouldn't be surprised if that wasn't the end for it.
So we have an honourable member with you. The honourable member Lorna Hussain.
Mr. Speaker, I have to say I've been really surprised by this intervention by the GSC. I honestly didn't expect it at all. I have no idea why the GSC would want to curb a vote when it suits them, while at the same time demand and consider it appropriate to be treated as an equal by the GRA when they have a leader that is not an elected member of the House. The double standards are totally palpable. And as for petty crusades, Mr. Speaker, I can talk a little bit about petty crusades. Petty crusades is, for example, when members by my side over here try to get me kicked out of the reception window to come and turn to come, and other such examples which there are many of. Those are petty crusades, Mr. Speaker. But clubbing the voice of another independent speaker, whether they rule them or not, is just an addition to a democratic voice here in this Parliament. So I have no idea why this would even be an issue, and I think it's a waste of parliamentary time. I, for one, welcome an extra voice in these benches to the Brexit Select Committee. Thank you.
So, we have a tribute to the political one moment to return. We are now going to run a speaker. I can see that you are with me.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I had hoped to say either very little or nothing at all during the course of this debate, but I think that the contribution of the Honourable Chief Minister has left me with no alternative but to rise and to give my own views. And the Honourable Chief Minister, he referred to logic, and what I'd like to do is to examine through the cold calculus of logic some of the issues that are at stake in this debate. Because I think that what we are doing today is setting a very dangerous precedent indeed, by simply inviting or electing somebody onto a select committee by dint of his status as an independent member of the House. And what I'd like to do is to examine very briefly what the role of a select committee is, not only in Gibraltar, but also elsewhere. Then look at the question of who does Mr. Rama actually represent? Because that lies at the heart of this debate. When we talk about somebody or a select committee being representative, we don't talk about a select committee being representative simply because somebody is in this House, a person represents people. And I'd like to examine more closely who exactly Mr. Rama represents. And then finally, Mr. Speaker, I'd like to draw a distinction, even though it's been particularly ungenerous to me today, but I would like to draw whatever it is the distinction between the Honourable Lady and the Honourable Gentleman. And I'll conclude with that. And I hope that I will be able to persuade members of the group that it's not the right course of action. I won't hold my breath, but nonetheless, let's examine some of the issues logically. Mr. Speaker, in the United Kingdom, select committees are convened on a
party basis, and I return to the concept of cross-party, he provided by Parliament with a very specific remit in order to report back to Parliament on its findings. It's then Parliament that makes the decision on any recommendation made by the Select Committee. There is no question of anybody having a vote by not forming part of a Select Committee, because of course, the Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Donald, will have as much of a say of what is recommended by the Select Committee as anybody else in the House, and nobody is trying to dampen a quiet or suppress the voice of Mr. Rama. In the UK, although there are differences between the Select Committee here and the UK, because in the UK, Select Committees are selected from the cadre of backbenchers. Very rarely do we see a front-bench spokesman, either on the government side or on the opposition side, being part of a Select Committee, because their function is usually to hold the government to account. But the way that they are chosen, I think, is instructive. And it's definitely usual to have a competition for places in a Select Committee. An individual may propose himself to a Select Committee, may be proposed by members of a political party, but what the Parliament actually does is it chooses the best people for a particular role in a particular Select Committee. There is not a Select Committee, a Parliament, I should say, in the way that could be said, because you are an independent member of the House, you've got to form part of a Select Committee. This is an absolute absurdity and an absolute nonsense with respect to the position that is being adopted today by the government. And this is being rejected. Look, Mr. Speaker, there have been other cases, and I know that the Honourable Gentleman in this case is going to draw a division from the other side and the usual response about the deal debating up among the rest of it. But with the 1975-76, the IWDP funded, you could have a situation in the future whereby, for whatever reason, you have seven members in the opposition that are all independent because of circumstances. I am seriously suggesting that in those circumstances, every single member of the opposition be called by dint of the fact that they are independent should form part of a Select Committee. That is nonsensical, and it's just a dangerous precedent. And in fact, Mr. Speaker, I probably would have stepped down, would have made no contribution back to the fact that the Chief Minister appeared to suggest, which caused me concern, that this is the precedent that we're establishing. Not only is it going to be this committee, but it's going to be the Constitutional Committee, it's also going to be the Committee on Parliamentary Reform. And let's look at it logically. Where Parliament is choosing and making a decision that is extremely important, choosing the people that the Parliament believes are best suited to be in a Select Committee to set out a roadmap about how Gibraltar deals with Brexit. But in other words, if the Honourable Chief Minister had come to his house today and he would say, look, we want to add one more person on the government side. The Honourable for Gilbert Fund, for example. Because we feel that his knowledge of public finance and of certain areas in the economy is such that he can make a valuable contribution. But because we do not want the Select Committee to become unwieldy, we're not going to be adding anybody else from the opposition side. Do you know what I would have said to the leader of the opposition and to my colleagues? I think that is a good enough reason, and therefore we should not object to what the government is trying to do. Because what we should be doing is we should be choosing the best people for this particular job, as indeed the best people for the role of the Select Committee of Constitutional Reform, and the best people for the role of the Constitutional Committee on Parliamentary Reform.
I work with Mr. Yannis, and he's just going to put his word with you. What did Mr. Yannis have to offer this particular select committee that Mr. McCullough doesn't have to offer, or Mr. McCullough, or Mr. Clinton with his experience in banking, or any select with his experience as a cross-border economic investigation, which could be useful in terms of considering justice and home affairs as part of Brexit deliberations. If we had been talking, for example, look, if we had been saying, this is a select committee, killing welfare, for example, I would have been the first one to say, and I'm not suggesting that that is the only time that the Honourable Gentleman has already can't contribute in other ways, but I would be facing it. I would be the first one to say. I would be the first one to say his expertise in second to none. But the reality is that to say that we're adding somebody by dint of the fact that he's an independent member of this house is not, in my respectful view, the right decision. And I know that the government will come back, and the government will say, yeah, that the Select Committee ought to be representative of this Parliament. And that lies at the heart of this debate. Because when you examine who Mr. Yannis actually represents, we are drawn to the inevitable conclusion that he represents no one, but he's not represented by the people here and the people here, Mr. Speaker. Look, the only gentleman who has mentioned the number of votes for Mr. Yannis obtained at the last election. Number one, Mr. Yannis obtained less votes than anybody else in this Parliament. Fact number two, a swing of 13 votes would have meant that Mr. Yannis would have been left out at the last election. Now, give the honourable gentleman an example that I wish the Parliament to consider. Let us assume that after nominations have closed, we've been selected for the GOD. After nominations have closed, Mr. Yannis turned around to the electorate, we couldn't have somebody else in the place. And Mr. Yannis turned around to the electorate in 2015 and said, I intend to allow the people of Gibraltar to vote for me as an independent. The reality, Mr. Speaker, the inescapable truth is that Mr. Yannis would never have been elected to this Parliament because, at the very least, there would have been a 3-13 vote against him in that 2 million of votes. And therefore, when we ask who does he actually represent, that the GOP does not actually represent, no one, Mr. Speaker, that is the reality of the situation. And I come to, Mr. Speaker, the difference between the Honourable Lady and the Honourable Mr. Lane. Because, you see, I think there is an important difference here. And if there hadn't been this difference, perhaps my view would have been different. The Honourable Lady has said, I intend to fight the next election and set up a political party. That's my understanding of her position. And she has said, look, even though I stood for election with the DOD in 2015, and I left within 6 months of being elected as part of the DOD slate, I will ask the people of Gibraltar to hold up in the balance with all the other positive things that I have done in the last 4 years. I want the people of Gibraltar to decide to elect me fine. But you have had the courage to come out and to say, I have an aspiration made through the headquarters, and I intend to fight for that election, and it's my aspiration to form a political party. I can say, what all my citizens in the world may be after how she is where she is now. But that is the reality. Now, Mr. Lama, we all know, not stupid, we all know, is not a lone wolf. he forms part of a political wing. One that prefers to work in the political shadow rather than coming out openly in broad daylight with a pack, nonetheless. What do you do to put that right? Should not take my mandate. I just need some labels into the misalignment for that Christmas message. He said, I'm acutely aware of the privilege that 7 years of independent MP represents. And of course, it's the same that he didn't have and feel that same privilege and honor to represent a people in the capacity that he was elected. But look, that's not the typological argument a man has to consider. Let's ignore that. But what he said was this. I swear a vision with a growing number of people who I've been working with. We believe that it is important that this new vision for Gibraltar be aligned to the dangers we have yet to articulate, whether homegrown or external. We believe that this vision requires honesty, regardless of whether we like what we find when we search within. Let me say, John Lee and others who already share these views, others who are keen to make a difference, who are keen to see the vision I have set out a moment ago become a reality. You can make a difference. We can make a difference. You see, the labor that you faced a few weeks ago asked Mr. Ramos for a credential position. Whether he was asking anyone direct that, what supplemental question he should ask next. Indeed. He's absolutely right. I have a lot of sympathy for the view that he expressed in Mr. Dempsey's position. Politics should not be conducted with charity. Politics is not a form of ventriloquism. Politics is to be conducted openly, Mr. Speaker. The Honourable Gentleman and I have had many battles over the years in this Parliament. Many, many battles. But nobody can accuse me of not saying to him in his face. That's the way that politics ought to operate. And Mr. Speaker, I say also, the majority of people in this Parliament have tasted defeat in politics in one form or another. The reality is that we've got to be able to take defeat in order to make success meaningful. I want to say, victory is only sweeter when you taste the defeat. But we've got to have the strength to be there. But you've got to have the courage in the back. That's why, whatever the other gentleman, that lady may say, whatever the other lady for sale for figures, which you have the courage to say, that's my aspiration. But the people that are on the line don't appear to have the same type of courage. If you're a political person and you aspire to lead this community, you've got to have the back. To say, I am going to stand as the leader of the political party. The same way as Mr. Clinton has the back to do so. Or if you don't agree with that political party, you've got to have the back to set up your own outfit. Openly, transparently, out of the shadows, into the full glare of the sunlight. But what you cannot and what is objectionable is to do what Mr. Yannis and his group are doing, which is operate
December gathering, as I have indicated a few moments ago. And Mr. Speaker, in the local world of the US Westinger MLA, where the real skin saving can stand up, And that, I'm afraid, is the message that this parliament,
But what we cannot do is just simply ignore reality and we ignore what is going on in this parliament and in politics today with Mr. Yanis and the people around him. And something that regularly the truth can affect knows that it knows has happened. And I, for one, cannot just remain stupid and not express my view about it. Mr. Speaker, thank you very much for your indulgence.
I contributor to this motion. If not, I will call. Yes, the Honourable Ryan Jennings. Mr. Speaker, I am grateful for the dynamic of throne on bringing this motion to the House, giving effect to the commitment of including independent members of the House in relevant select committees. And I look forward to contributing in this select committee and any other further select committees requiring our attention as we move forward. Unfortunately, Mr. Speaker, it is never my intention to cause any harm to the GSP whatsoever. It has certainly not been my intention to do anything that may in any way negatively influence the process of consolidation, repair, and rebuilding, which I will expect the GSP is engaging following its leadership election. It is clear on the party's own admission that the GSP is at a critical juncture in its path. And in that context, the return of incredible and capable people who once sat on that executive should be welcomed and not resisted. It would seem, Mr. Speaker, that Mr. Susan is a major successful possibility that I have developed a rapport with such people. People who remain GSP members and people who hope and keep the possibility of rebuilding bridges alive. This is, in my view, the approach the current leader is hoping to engender, and I would have expected and would have welcomed a more positive approach, especially from Mr. Speaker. I do not wish to reopen the reasons for which I left and resigned from the party I once did. For whatever reason, and from the party's own admission, there was a communication breakdown on such an important issue. And on the analysis of facts, I have been left out of a decision-making process on such an important bill such as the Appropriation Bill. It is my view, Mr. Speaker, at the time, that I had to put Gibraltar first and my party second. It is my view that voting against the budget, however much I agree with the argument put in favour, Gibraltar, on the contest with a Brexit backdrop, need to unite. Mr. Speaker, Gibraltar at this point in time needs parliamentarians to have faith and to support the government of the day and to show a vote of confidence in Gibraltar, its economy, in its workers, and in its public service. Mr. Speaker, unfortunately, the main opposition party, the GSP, failed to realize the implications of their actions or lack thereof. When the original motion for the Brexit Select Committee arrived in this House, they unfortunately allowed the original motion, forming various Select Committees, debated in the House and the South, to go through. But then, they made absolutely no mention of any dissatisfaction with this setup, and therefore endorse what they might consider a weakening of the GSP opposition. This, once again, Mr. Speaker, exposes the lack of foresight the GSP has and the characteristic hypocrisy of the party. It is quite rich, Mr. Speaker, for a party who has a leader in this House and a party who has a leader outside the House to make representations to the GRA on challenging the legitimacy
of how those parts are done by GDP. Even though the leader of the party does not enjoy a seat in this house, that's for Mr. Speaker, it is the audacity to challenge a democratic legitimate participation of a member of this house in the Senate committee. Mr. Speaker, it's deplorable and we simply could not make it up. All this, Mr. Speaker, by still publicly declaring a desire for the return of past members. It is awfully confusing, Mr. Speaker, but awfully confusing is what the GST appears to have become. A leader inside and a leader outside. Being led, or perhaps misled, by the other independent member to make joint statements is utterly confusing. Mr. Speaker, the group is asking who I represent. And yes, I do do my homework, and I'm committed to what I do. So, GST is asking who I represent. Well, Mr. Speaker, I represent those who contact me, those who know I am always on the other side, and Mr. Speaker, in particular, I represent many of the GST members who are lost, many of the electors who are lost. What policies do I have, Mr. Speaker? I am not one to judge myself. I shall let the electors do that if I do stand again. But what I can say is that by a group of us, a vision and initiative which so far has failed to provide this community. And as a former member of my party, a former colleague, should I say, I consider my parliamentary allowance to be simply a stepping stone in order to fulfill my commitments in this house and a way in which I can provide for my family. I do not consider it, Mr. Speaker, to be my holiday money. Mr. Speaker, for me, it is a privilege to serve this community, and I shall ensure and endeavor that that privilege is always met. No doubt, Mr. Speaker, I shall be voting in favor of this motion on the basis that it is legitimate that I should be included following the precedent set in this House by all its members. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I rise only to talk about numbers. I'm glad to do this by people's voices. Mr. Speaker, the original composition from the race goes of the original structure of the impact of its plans today is in the proportion of 42-1. I'm happy to be corrected on that. But the proposed amendment, it becomes 5-2-1-1. So from the point of view of the opposition, regardless of the arguments we've heard this afternoon, the official opposition of which the government must recognize we have a majority on the opposition benches, there being five of us, no longer have a majority of the opposition views in that select committee. And whereas the government's been very careful to ensure that they're representative majority is retained, we, being the official opposition, have left that. And, Mr. Speaker, it is in that point I feel that the proposed amendment is inequitable. The way we're going to have to do is that when there are members from the official opposition, I don't know that we might be satisfied in terms of ratio at the very least. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
I'm calling the moment to reply. Yes, Mr. Speaker. I think we need to get a know that when we tabled a two-line two-line motion for the House, it was going to lead to this kind of discussion. But I have to say that in 19 years as a member of this House, I have seldom heard such nonsense coming from and the social media. And I think the only thing that was unfortunate and what it was remarkable that this motion had been presented. But the unfortunate and remarkable, I think, is the lack of pure political acumen that will continue to display both in this house and outside. I'm afraid that the rationale for the motion has not been fully explained. I'm afraid that the reality is that the rationale has been fully explained to them. It has been fully explained by me, by you now, to the other member, when he asked what it was. And I told him then, and I read from the email, the position of the government is that the select committee should contain as wide a representation of Parliament as possible. We believe that Mr. Ramos is therefore entitled to be on the committee and have his views heard within its formal structure. It is also our view that the committee should be composed of one more government MP than all the opposition MPs combined. The proposed arrangement for the Brexit Select Committee will provide for the opposition MPs, will provide for four opposition MPs and five government MPs. The further expansion of the committee that runs the risk of making it unwieldy and unworkable in the context of the voter, with six government MPs, with six government MPs to continue to sit as members of the committee for no good reason. And then I told him that, you know, we had to agree to disagree on this one. So you see that the rationale behind the decision taken by the government to propose the motion was fully and properly explained to the honourable member opposite. And, you know, when we're going to accuse the government of indulging in party politics over this issue, I mean, the reality is that we're indulging in their own internal interest opposition party politics. It really has got absolutely nothing to do with that. When we were able to elect the opposition, the official opposition, as Mr. Ramos, I think, has rightly explained, the government then needs to change the structure of all the select committees and decided to add the honourable lady to each government. Then, to balance that, a government MP was also added to each of those committees. So, Mr. Ramos, what we are doing now, proposing to do now with Mr. Ramos, is exactly what we did when the honourable lady left the official opposition. It is exactly the same. We believe, as I said, that there should be as wide a representation of parliamentary views as possible on the committee. What we cannot do is to add an opposition, an MP from the official opposition, every time that an MP is added or an independent MP is added to the committee. That would then require us to add a government MP as well. And when that was replaced, we had more than half a government sitting on the select committee. We think that is simply not possible and is not going to happen. So we took a view, as I said, and Mr. Ramos is entitled to be honest, and whatever view he may take, but first on the important subject of that book is therefore entitled to sit in the committee and to express it. But most of them, I mean, Simon was said earlier about who represents who and who to best represent. The reality, Mr. Speaker, is that, as Mr. Wright has said, members are elected individually, and that we sit as members, or members of Parliament, also on that select, on each or any select committee. But this situation reflects very poorly, not on the government, as I believe that the opposition has said, but I think the petty, short-sighted and mistaken approach they have taken reflects very poorly on them, Mr. Speaker. That they should seek to exclude an independent member with clearly different views to them and to the other independent members from expressing an opinion on the select committee is unacceptable and undemocratic. But what is to be fair, I think, a singular lack of knowledge of what select committees are for and how they work. You know, I've had the opportunity to sit on every select committee from the past, in the last maybe 20 years, there have been a number of it. And the only one that would know that is that this idea of having more MPs in the official opposition than independent MPs on the committee, that they really show that they don't know what they're talking about, because each individual member represented on the committee is free to dissent or to disagree with the view expressed by the majority of members on that committee. And the Campbell, and there are, in the UK and in other places, there is a majority report expressing the majority view of the committee on any given issue. And there are also minority reports and minority views expressed on whatever that it might be. So the actual manner, the procedures, the way in which the committee operates, allows for that to happen already. It does not require for that to be more position, more institutions in the official opposition than there are independent members on it. And I don't think that's clear, so that I think it's particularly inappropriate, and I did raise this issue with them too, that they should choose to raise this particular issue with this particular committee, which is a select committee about Brexit, which is a hugely important issue at that time, not only for Gibraltar, but also for the wider United Kingdom and European Union, where we have tried, I think, as far as possible to be as united as we can in the views that we express, in the information that we provide to the other members of the group, and we are trying to work together for the wider interests of the group. And there are other committees already in existence, whether to the person with you and have behaved in this special and inappropriate manner with regard to those issues, which are still also considerably important. I wouldn't try to diminish that, but I'm judging it together. To keep judgment, to raise this issue is wrong. And then, I think it was mentioned that the federal and Mr. Ramos were the last one who had been elected and that it took a swing of 10 or 13 votes. But I think my answer to that is a really fascinating answer. My answer to that is that look, members are elected and elected are left by one vote. So if it was 13 or 9 or 10 or 15, it would be it, but it just takes one vote to be an election. That is what democracy really is all about. And who do we represent? So you see that all 17 of us represent the 32,000 people of Gibraltar. That is who we represent. Each of us represents all the people of Gibraltar. Not the people who voted for you. So I think, as I said before, it is intolerant of different opinions, it is wicked, it is undemocratic, it is holier than thou, and is an approach to politics that we thought was confined to the destiny of history in 2011. So I was very sorry to hear it was resurrected again in this particular motion on Brexit. You see, as I said earlier, the government values having independent voices on the committee. It is our policy that those voices should be there. And then, before I close in the motion, I'll give you a moment to remember, I think, what the member wants to go through with.
I'm grateful to the Honourable Gentleman for giving way, Mr. Speaker. Because in the course of the intervention that the Honourable former leader of the official opposition, and he told us that he had considered not making any intervention, and that is something I said that moved him to become involved in referring us to the calculus, the cold calculus of logic. From the beginning, what he was missing is the advocacy of parliamentary mathematics. And that's what he should have put in the balance. And the advocacy of parliamentary mathematics tells us that we started with 10, and we still got 10, this thing was 7. Another left one, another left, another one. And for that reason, Mr. Speaker, it was necessary for us to act in the way that we are going to act by supporting the motion that the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister put before the House. And we started with a theory, Mr. Speaker, that because Mr. Rama no longer sits with the DHB whip, he now represents no one. Or at least no one of the DSP doesn't also already represent. Although he wants us to think
that does not apply to the Honourable Lady, because she said that she's going to stand for election with a political party in the future. So, Mr. Speaker, that may be true about the future. But the Honourable Lady may seek her own independent mandate in the future. The Honourable Lady's position is, as you know, whether he shares with you or not, that she has an independent mandate today, because she has 4,892 votes. That's the position. Why should the position available to Kalama, who had 4,565 votes, be any different? She's made an investment of infinite intention to stand for election in the future. With her, with them, with us, or with her. And that doesn't change this position, Mr. Speaker. Don't you do it? Today, and the regard we must have for the democratic legitimacy of this position in the House. He then presented the work of the Select Committee as if we hadn't, on this side, understood what the work of the Select Committee is. Here in the United Kingdom, and indeed in the work of the former Select Committees that have been in the South, including the important ones, like the ones in the Constitution. It's because we understand the work of the Select Committee that we have thought it appropriate to bring this motion and have indicated that we will bring similar motions in respect of other Select Committees. And he told us, in one breath, that the difference is not great enough, and then he then told us, in another breath, in what was clearly the speaker, a further bit of peak. But there are some within the community who are working with the Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Lama. Well, Mr. Speaker, we may not be a million miles away from thinking, but breaking up is hard to do unless we're in the deal these days. Because the breakup doesn't seem to have ended yet. The people may not have become entirely visible to all of us on this side of the House or in the public yet. The example we gave of the breakup of the IWDP is perhaps the wrong example for interpretation, for a simple reason. Good students of history, other than those who have lived history, like Mr. Osama or Mr. Speaker, good students of history will have read in the Deputy Chief Minister's book on the political history of Gibraltar that, in fact, those who stood with the Gibraltar Democratic Movement didn't just leave the GDM after the breakup of the other movie, they left the GDM and then were seduced by the capital of a formidable actor, then as leader of the House, and they broke the law. They didn't become independent, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Mascarenhas Mr. Mascarenhas, not a member, right? Mr. Brown, Pérez, and Mr. Valerino crossed the floor, Mr. Speaker, at the time. They did not stay independent, Mr. Speaker. So that is not the best example to show them. And what if they all went independent, Mr. Speaker? Well, he didn't say that this wouldn't happen, which is interesting. Some members said, what happens if we all go independent? Well, that's said, but of course that won't happen. Because of course, the underlying tensions of the very who do appear on the other side of the field from Mr. Clinton, Mr. Royal. But I look up and the rest of what I see is PDP and Labour Party. So it could still go. And Lenin has been willing to go. What happens if they don't go independent? Well, then, Mr. Speaker, I suppose we would ask them, as a group of independents, to nominate. Who would like for the country to be independent from the Select Committee? Because it would be impossible, Mr. Speaker, to have the Select Committee of the House with 7 independents in it without having at least 8 members of the government. But then there would not be an official opposition. And you realize that the example that you postulate lacks logic, because there is no official opposition in that example. There are 7 independent members. It's a reality, and that's not what we're dealing with. And if there are people, Mr. Speaker, in the DFP who are working with Mr. Lama, as he has said today, well then, Mr. Speaker, it's important that we hear their voice and let me for him, for him, for the philosophy working with them. He's legitimized the exercise that we're doing in that respect. He pretends to try and drive a wedge between us and the other half, but then, of course, we were saying, so if you were found to be a member of the executive committee, well, then we would take it as a policy. So Jerry the gentleman thinks that we did not ask Sir Jerry Wassana whether he wanted to be a member of the select committee before we determined who should be in the select committee. But we should know that they're well enough that Sir Jerry said he wants to spend more time being just respectable and give us his input in cabinet, which we think the person we have the benefit of the input of Sir Jerry Wassana, of Jerry Wassana, who mentioned, but this is for Iran, Neil Costa, from Agassi, from John Cortez, from Stephen Lavis. We don't need to bring them into a select committee to hear their contribution. So, frankly, it is nonsensical to have made that attempt to drive away between us. We meet together in the Uber select committee in the London building. I wouldn't be surprised to have got to he said, in such a revolutionary fashion that it was impossible for him, to speak to the Honourable Gentleman, to not demonstrate the utter vindictiveness with which he has approached this debate. Now, we saw some of that vindictiveness in the very legendary press conference that he gave when he retired as a leader of the GOP. He talked about dogs and canine issues, and I'm not going to talk about crocodiles and tears, but we saw some of the we saw some of that vindictiveness then. If Mr. Yama is putting together a group, it is even more important that we hear what he has to say from the select committee. If we are people of opinion, we must hear their views. But how do we know that he represents no one but the people who voted to us? Is it that we don't have secret elections into government, Mr. Speaker? We have a secret ballot, don't we? How does he know that the 4,565 people who voted for Ronald Ramos are included in the 5,054 that voted for him? How do you know that? There's enough difference, Mr. Speaker, between 10,852, which is the number of people that voted for me, and 5,054, the number of people that voted for him, that they could represent the 4,765 that voted for him. How do you work that out? People that voted for him might have been called preacher and king, and people that voted for him might have been called Nod and Baron. All we know, Mr. Speaker. So it is such a nonsense to say his votes are represented by the GOP. It is so remarkable because we have heard that in this house today. And the Labour gentleman was not the Labour gentleman who wasn't put on it, then to refer to the Honourable Gentleman as a wolf and talk about canine aspects of what he does. And Mr. Speaker, to think that he got up and said that it was wrong to have referred to a doctor when the Honourable Gentleman wasn't here, and then he's now talked about canine aspects of what the Honourable Gentleman can be an expert at, and talk about wolves. The critical day was never clearer than at that moment. But it wasn't on this side of the figure. The critical day was on the list of the Honourable Gentleman. And I apologize to Mr. Phillips, who's the leader of the official opposition, because I thought he was getting his, talk from WhatsApp and from beyond the fact. He wasn't going to get across the way from next door. He didn't need an electronic device. He had the former leader of the opposition to give him all of the vindictiveness and toughness that was required, because that was still what was coming across. But for him, it's for real people to go back and say that politics is not ventriloquy. I look to Michael Bowen. That's what I said. But I will say one thing, Mr. Speaker, to the other gentleman. It is true that in politics, and here he and I are fully in agreement. You want to succeed, you have to suffer defeat as well. you will recall, the editorial of the former editor of the Gibraltar Chronicle, who referred to the cold steel of an election night. Cold steel, that we have both felt on election night, as a speaker. That is absolutely true. I've given another quote to Max Lewandowski again. Nixon said on the day of his impeachment that his supporters and those who worked with him should not have pity for him, because it was only by being in the lowest valley that he could understand the value of having been atop the highest mountain, namely to have held the office of President of the United States. If somebody wants to hold high office as a speaker, they have to have the courage to suffer defeat in elections. Otherwise, you know, the political system that they want to operate in is not the political system that he and I have operated in with relative amounts of success. So, Mr. Speaker, he talked about, in all of that context, people having to come out of the shadows. But he was the only one shadowboxing in the course of this debate. He was the only one who seemed to be talking not at Mr. Yamas, but at someone else, Mr. Speaker, in the course of this debate. In fact, I will say that one of the reasons I miss him so much, Mr. Speaker, because he's probably is the only person who can masquerade as handsome in the way that he presents himself in debate, whilst actually being petty and vindictive like no one else. But to talk about wolves, Mr. Speaker, when he's the perennial wolf in sheep's clothing, especially in the way that he's presented the argument today. And I don't know if you have seen reach that level of discord in the context of a debate and enlarging the Brexit Select Committee, something as important as Deputy Chairman said, as Brexit. I can only say, Mr. Speaker, that in the first of the things that Mr. Lamas has said, when he referred to the characteristic hypocrisy of the GOP, I sometimes feel with him that I found a political soulmate, Mr. Speaker. And when the handset of this debate is available, I will ask him to autograph a copy of his speech and give it to me for posterity. Because it is absolutely right, Mr. Speaker, that honorable members of the official opposition of the debate present themselves as wanting democratic legitimacy and wanting parliamentary debate, and then when we come to a moment where we seek parliamentary involvement, they try and shut it down. I can only say one thing, Mr. Speaker, to the community today after this debate. The Deputy Chief Minister, the Attorney General, the Cabinet, the Financial Secretary, who is an important part of the team also, the Brexit team must be doing a pretty good job for Gibraltar if the opposition think that the use of parliamentary time to which they put the last hour makes any sense in the context of the challenges facing this community today. And Mr. Speaker, I know that the Deputy Minister will now rise to commend the motion to the House. Before he does, I will say, Mr. Speaker, that involving the Honourable Gentleman opposite, I think, is a demonstration of the inclusiveness of the debate that we want to have in the context of this difficult moment. But that today, in this debate, more than one mask has slipped. And once they slip, they can never go back.
I propose a question in return to the motion made by the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against?
If I think it is appropriate for the purposes of history and hand-drag to be called a division.
All right.
Aaron Clinton.
No.
Gary Cooper.
Aye.
Eric Costa.
Aye.
Daniel Stephen.
No.
Gary Gilbert.
Yes.
Ian Hammond.
Nope.
Do you have a question?
Yes.
Do you like the food?
Numbers are absent. There are 10 votes in favor. 5 against. Before we move on to the next motion, there is something that I feel bound to say. And I must bring your attention to the honorable members to the rules of debate, Rule 35. Members of the interaction are number 6 point of order, and we tend to elucidate some matter raised by another member in the course of his speech. Provided that the member speaking is willing to give way and pursuing his speech, and that the member wishing to interact is called by the speaker for a turn. I think the intervention this afternoon of the Honourable the Leader of the House goes beyond that. It goes beyond the spirit of that rule. Whether it happened on Sunday, at some time between 1991 and 2012, this fact is true. It didn't happen during the years that I was a member of the House of Assembly. Yes, a member of this role, say on the government side or on the opposition side, to give one of his colleagues an opportunity to make a point. But to make a point is not to make a speech. And what we have had this afternoon from the Chief Minister is a speech. And also the government have really had two rights of reply. And that is one. When the Honourable Mr. Speaker spoke, it's expected that the Chief Minister would want to answer him. If it had been the other way around, if Mr. Speaker had spoken before the Chief Minister had spoken the debate, he would have answered him in the course of his speech. But of course, having lost the opportunity in the debate, he then had to ask his colleague to give way in order to make a speech answering Mr. Speaker. I believe sincerely as Speaker that that is not the spirit of this rule. I hope honorable members will agree. I hope the Chief Minister will agree that he went beyond the bounds of clarifying the point. Now, given that it is also incumbent on the Speaker to call a member, because the rule says only a member must give way until the Speaker has to call a member, I feel today that the spirit of that rule has been exceeded. And I hope that that practice will not continue in whatever time there remains for me to be Speaker, because if it were to continue, then I will invoke the rule which says, which requires that I call the member, because then I will not call on the member to interrupt. Having said that, we are already given
The questions have been built up from the time that you have not been here, but I think your ruling is a helpful one, and we shall ensure that, of course, we abide by your ruling and the spirit of the rule that you have referred us to, which I have no doubt is exactly as we should be behaving. But honourable members will know that so much talk of super rules, and it was essential that I go back and reply. Mr. Speaker, I think this might be a convenient moment for us to recess for 15 minutes for a comfort break before we come back to deal with other business.
We have this place for 15 minutes. Thank you.
The Minister for Health and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honor to move the motion standing in my name, which reads as follows. This House acknowledges the work of our excellent district justice of the peace and the Gibraltar Court Service in upholding the high standards of judicial independence and ensuring the effective administration and delivery of justice in Gibraltar. Note the oath made by the Minister with responsibility for justice pursuant to the Judicial Services Act 2007, which provided the Minister to discharge his duty to ensure the provision of resources for the efficient and effective support of the court. Note of the appointment of 10 of judges on a temporary basis to deal with legal arises with a short-term means of judicial, namely backlog of specific types of cases dates back to 2011. Further note that in 2014, a need was identified for a first judge to be employed on a temporary short-term basis for a period of 3 years in order to clear a general backlog of civil cases in the Supreme Court, and that, with the context having come to an end, the backlog being cleared, and in the context of budget, the government deemed a first judge in that role and at that time necessary to the effective working of the court. Note that the Honourable Mr. Justice, Deputy Chief Justice, at the opening of the legal year on the 29th of September 2017, stated that when it did not have any legitimate expectation that the post would continue beyond the 3 year term, two, it was always clear to him that the funding was made to provide for the short term needs of the judiciary, and that this was not a permanent increase to the judicial complement, and, I quote, the judiciary, like any public service, needs to justify the need for resources, and that includes justifying an increase in the judicial complement. I will be monitoring the impact which the reduction in the number of judges has upon the workings of the court, and if the evidence justifies it, I will seek to persuade government to reconsider its funding decision. And that's all there. But the government should, in close consultation with the Honourable Chief Justice and the Bar Council, keep the caseload of the court and the waiting times for cases and attention to you, so that if evidence justifies it, the need for a fourth judge may be reconsidered in order to meet the short-term needs of the judiciary, and that SPV should pay particular attention to future demands regarding complex and high-value litigation and any impact of the proposed legal assistance reform may have on current resources. Mr. Speaker, I am pleased to say that the text of this government motion has been agreed with the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition, and therefore calls for the support of the official opposition. I am also pleased to say, Mr. Speaker, that both Honourable Independent Members, the Honourable Ms. Malay Hassan, and the Honourable Mr. Lawrence Granner have also agreed, and that therefore the motion enjoys support of the whole House. There is no doubt in my mind, Mr. Speaker, none whatever, that our judiciary upholds at all times the high standards of judicial independence, and that the service works tirelessly in ensuring the effective administration and delivery of justice in Gibraltar. I remind Parliament, Mr. Speaker, of the oath which, as Minister for Responsibility for Justice, I took under the Judicial Services Act. The oath provides, among other vital duties, that I will ensure the provision of resources for the efficient and effective support of the court. Mr. Speaker, this is a duty that I, like all the previous incumbents in the post, have taken with the utmost seriousness.
and we have all given the oath the weight and attention it deserves. In fact, it is an opportune moment to note that the investment and commitment of the Majesty's Government of Gibraltar, as well as the excellent work of the judiciary and court services, has meant that there continues to be no factor at the Magistrates Court and the Supreme Court in respect of those provided for criminal trials and for civil and family applications waiting for first hearing dates. Furthermore, the Gibraltar Court Service continues to modernize and improve the services provided to court users. And this is first since October 2016. Court users can enjoy the use of Wi-Fi facilities in all of the courtrooms. The Gibraltar Court Service website continues to be regularly updated with judgments being available for the Supreme Court and Court of Appeal since 1997 to date. Since 2016, sentencing pronouncements for criminal trials at the Supreme Court are also available to download from the website, enabling the general public and the service users to keep up to date with court decisions. Further, the names of the Gibraltar judgments website continues to be up to date, with all reported judgments since 1812 available for download, with future reported judgments to be uploaded subsequent to the publication in the Gibraltar Law Report volume. The Gibraltar Court Service is constantly looking at ways in which to improve their services and level of performance, with court users today enjoying a modernized, open and accessible court service through which the public can have access to the justice system. Of course, Mr. Speaker, I think all of the Chief Justice has pointed out, the maintenance provision for the administration of justice in a small jurisdiction such as ours is as much an art as a science. It is, when one looks at, for example, the number of senior judges required, an art that necessitates finding the right balance between having sufficient resilience to cope with unforeseen extraordinary demands whilst not being at the same time over-resourced and therefore wasteful. Such a delicate assessment is all the more necessary given the uncertainty that the current legislative position brings to us all. It is against this background, Mr. Speaker, that the question of appointing additional judges on a temporary basis is, in the government's view, adequate and sufficient to address the short-term needs of the judiciary, namely, backlog of specific types of cases, such as criminal trials or complex commercial matters. The permission, Mr. Speaker, as I have occasion to note previously, dates back to 2011 and commenced under the then GSD administration. The criteria set out for such an appointment by the then Minister for Justice is the same as it is today. Short-term appointments will be made, and I quote, for a limited period to help with the backlog of cases and the idea to have a temporary appointment. So effectively, as and when there is no need for that sort of judge, we will go back to see judges, end quote. It is on exactly the same basis, Mr. Speaker, that the government decided that the most recent appointment of a fourth judge in 2014, which was for a fixed 3-year period to deal with a backlog of civil cases, was no longer necessary for the efficient and effective support of the court. This decision was made in the context of the backlog having been cleared and, as mentioned, in the context of Brexit. The motion, Mr. Speaker, sets out the most salient point that the error of the Chief Justice has set out in the context of judicial resourcing, meaning that he did not have any legitimate expectation that the post would continue beyond a 3-year term. He was always clear to him that the funding was made to provide for the short-term needs of the judiciary and that this was not a permanent increase in the judicial complement and that, and I quote, the judiciary, like any public service, needs to justify the need for resources, and that includes justifying an increase of the judicial complement. I will be monitoring the impact which the reduction in the number of judges has upon the workings of the court, and if the evidence justifies it, I will seek state government to reconsider its final decision. End quote. It is also, Mr. Speaker, important to note that the Honourable the Chief Justice set out that, in the context of the decrease in civil claims, the government's decision was not unreasonable and that the 3 remaining judges should be able to cope with the demands that are made by the Supreme Court. Mr. Speaker, the aim of the Chief Justice has to date not sought to persuade the government to reconsider its standing decision. Mr. Speaker, it is of course right that I and the government should keep the caseload of the court under waiting times for cases under constant review, and that this should be in consultation with the Chief Justice and all relevant stakeholders. Mr. Speaker, as in 2011 and as in 2014, if the evidence justifies it, funding for short-term fixed-period penal drugs will be made available to meet the needs of the district at that point in time. I'm more than happy for the need to keep this under review to be included in the face of the motion as it is already the case. I'm also happy to agree that the possible areas that should be most closely monitored are those of high-value civil litigation and the possible impact of the legal assistance reform on judges' caseload.
I now propose a question in the terms of the motion moved by the Honourable the Minister for Health. Does anybody wish to
make that call upon the Honourable in the legal representation?
Mr. Speaker, firstly, I'd like to seek leave at this time to withdraw the motion that was planned on the 30th of October 2017 in respect of this particular issue of the authorization. Mr. Speaker, the starting point for my contribution, of course, was the original motion that we've now sought leave to withdraw. Both the Minister and I have enjoyed a useful discussion in an attempt to deal with the content of this motion, which has been agreed by way of consensus and agreement. And although we describe it, Mr. Speaker, as a joint motion, clearly the reason it provides for a joint approach in the way it was suggested, and therefore mechanically it's been done in this way. First, the Minister of Justice and I met just the redraft that was circulated in it. It's our hope, Mr. Speaker, that the joint motion will reflect the unquestionable support that this has for and has for the function and role of judiciary in our community and the administration of justice. Mr. Speaker, it is, of course, common ground that all members of this House hold in high regard the work being done by our judges to preserve, protect, and advance the administration of justice in Gibraltar. Our judges are very ably supported by the work of civil servants and in the court service. Mr. Speaker, there is a strong bond between the legal profession, the courts, and many of us in this House who have the privilege of working in the court environment on each day. Many of us will recall fondly not only our time preparing and appearing before our judges, past and present, but also the friendly and efficient interaction with the court service and the registry. I'm sure that both, if you were here, the Minister of Housing and Mr. McGee, who has been here, will remember our many interactions as opponents at the bar and almost daily contact in a set of interesting cases which dominated the resources of the acting Speaker, whoever he was then. Our legal profession, Mr. Speaker, our judiciary and our courts have seen radical changes in the last 16 years. We have all in this House been impressed with the investment that the Minister talked about in his contribution and the redevelopment of our courts into a modern court complex with any standards. And from comments that I've seen from visiting professional cousins, our courts are the envy of many of the British overseas territories. Speaker, we have four Supreme Court rooms which can cater for any type of case, from common law school, international commercial disputes, including commercial trust disputes, to serious crimes involving vulnerable witnesses. I'm proud of what we are able, what we have done in respect of investment into our court infrastructure and our human capital. I'm especially proud as a commercial litigator when I'm asked to express a view of our court structure and our judges and to demonstrate to the outside world of the high value and the high regard that our judiciary is held by people abroad. Mr. Speaker, if we are serious, and this will be reason why the original motion was put in that language. If we are serious about attracting good business to our homeland, then we have to be equally serious about ensuring that we respond accordingly to having a robust judicial resource that can be called upon by litigants to have their disputes adjudicated here. Our legal disputes are becoming more complex, more technical, with value for some cases eclipsing our own GDP. Dealing with cases such as these brings new opportunities to develop our jurisprudence even further and to show to the outside world that we are able to adjudicate important cases that involve the common law. Justice Kamen, the BBI, Jersey and Guernsey have developed a body of trust law, for instance, to say for the win. Mr. Speaker, if we are serious about creating more access to justice from those who can't afford to vindicate their rights in terms of the legal assistance, we will need a robust and flexible justice system that delivers Canadian citizen. Mr. Speaker, the government has announced, following a consultation with the legal profession, that the government intends to increase the threshold for legal assistance from £5,000 to £14,000, which may well see an increase in litigation before our court. We should be alive to the impact of those reforms on our judicial resources, and I think it's appropriate that the Minister has in his speech relation on the second page referred to that specifically after our discussion at his offices. This is something that both the Minister and I have focused a great deal of time on. This has been unfortunate both Mr. Lafuri and Ms. Sacramento and Mr. Speaker have to be involved in very complex and high-value litigation from which time to time places very significant pressures on the resources of our court. Members will know that it doesn't take long for fairly dozen judges to be entirely overtaken by one complex criminal or commercial case. It is said by the government and also by the Attorney General in his speech at the opening of the legal year that the number of actions instituted may be down on previous years. That is right, Mr. Speaker, but on the ground, cases are becoming more complex and more document heavy than ever before, and therefore we should be careful to rely solely on statistics in an area which requires a degree of flexibility. Mr. Speaker, the Chairman of the Bar in the opening of the legal year said, amongst other things, the number of cases are only a small and not a decisive indicator of the need for judicial resources nowadays, he said. The lower numbers of cases that hit the courts are also significantly more complex, both in terms of issues that they raise and in terms of the volume of paper that they generate. That requires resources. In a jurisdiction with three or four Supreme Court judges, it is easy to see the emergence of a couple of complex trust matters, or long criminal matter in fact, put a judge out of action for a long time. Mr. Speaker, the Chief Justice, in his unprecedented statement, also said that the judiciary required this degree of flexibility. And he said the workload of the court cannot be measured exclusively by relying upon statistics, but it is also dependent upon the complexity of matters coming before the court. The Chief Justice went on to say, because we are demand-led, it is also useful to retain an element of flexibility which the extra judicial resource provides. Therefore, whilst I understand the decision not to fund the post of a third feeling judge at this stage, it is one that I will speak to the State of Majesty's Government to reconsider. Mr. Speaker, the frontline litigators on both sides of this House will appreciate the force of those points that I've raised on this issue. The motion, Mr. Speaker, has been brought to this House on a joint basis in a collaborative approach, as both sides of this House clearly wish to ensure that our judiciary receives appropriate support it needs to perform its vital function. I have set out, Mr. Speaker, two practical examples which I hope reflect on the ground view in response to the reduction of judicial resources. There are, of course, are important matters of principle that I'd just like to raise very shortly thus far, in terms of this measure being adopted so far by the government. On the 17th of August, Mr. Speaker, the government said that the reduction of the number of Supreme Court judges will not make our court less agile or robust. Secondly, the government said that the policy of fixed-term judicial appointments was implemented by the GSD. Thirdly, it was said on behalf of the government that in 2014, a need was identified for fourth judge to be employed on a temporary fixed-term basis in order to clear the backlog of civil cases in the Supreme Court. Fourthly, Mr. Speaker, it said that the fixed-term had come to an end, and in the context of Brexit, the fourth judge was deemed unnecessary for the effective working of the court. If I can deal with the particular arguments that were deployed by the government in this way. Firstly, as regards GSD policy, yes, the government is correct. Just as the government has done, the former GSD administration had utilised fixed-term judicial contracts in line with the Commonwealth Latin House principles on the three branches of the government. Latin House addressed the question of judicial appointments and said judicial appointments should normally be permanent, whilst in some jurisdictions, contract appointments may be inevitable. Such appointments could be subject to appropriate security tenure. Secondly, the appointment of judges on fixed-term contracts requires special justification. Secondly, Mr. Speaker, Latimer House acknowledges that fixed-term contracts in small jurisdictions may be inevitable, where there is a certain dependence with the legal skills and experience required at that level. However, Mr. Speaker, the Venice Commission recommends strongly against the use of fixed-term contracts appointment for ordinary judges due to the concern about judicial independence. Although the Commission makes an exception for constitutional judges who are appointed to fixed-term contracts in some European countries. It is true, Mr. Speaker, that the making of non-permanent judicial appointments is controversial, and the IBA minimum standards of judicial independence in 1982 recommended that practice should be avoided as far as possible, except where there exists a long democratic tradition. In summary, Mr. Speaker, there is clearly a debate about the efficacy of fixed-term contracts, but I'm inclined to agree with the Minister of Justice. And in a small place like Gibraltar, and in an absence of willing members of senior members of the bar to able to make that contribution to our legal precedent, we may need to look beyond our country for suitable candidates on fixed-term appointments. In our view, it is not a question of the efficacy of the fixed-term appointments, it's a question of funding. This brings me to the second point. The government has said that with the contract having come to an end, the backlog cleared, and in the context of Brexit, the court has been deemed unnecessary for the effective working of the court. Mr. Speaker, as the Minister of Justice did refer to in his contribution, he has sworn oath to the Council on the Section 7 of the Judicial Service Act, which guarantees respect for the rule of law, defence of the independence of judiciary, and a discharge of duty to ensure the provision, and this is the key point, provision of resources to the end for the and effective support of the court. Mr. Speaker, the Chief Justice, in his unprecedented statement, and the Chairman of the Bar are clear in their views, which I have already repeated this time, and I'm telling Mr. Speaker that he also repeated the comments from the beginning of the year. I know from my dealing with the government, particularly Minister of Justice, and Mr. that they will keep a close eye on judicial resources with close consultation with the Chief Justice, the Bar Council, and the Bar generally, given the likelihood that they may have to return to the fourth provision within our judiciary. Mr. Speaker, this brings me neatly to the main thrust of the position, and that is one of funding, which is an important thread running through. Mr. Speaker, Principle Roman 4b, Guideline 2 of the Latin House Principles declares the following. Sufficient and sustainable funding should be provided to enable the judiciary to perform its functions to the highest standards. Such funds, once voted for by the judiciary by the legislature, should be protected. The footnote to that declaration states the following. The provision of adequate funding for the judiciary must be a very high priority in order to uphold the rule of law, to ensure that good governance and democracy are sustained, and to provide for the effective and efficient administration of justice. However, it is acknowledged that a shortfall in anticipated national income might lead to budgetary constraints. Finance ministers are urged to engage in appropriate consultations in order to set realistic and sustainable budgets where Parliament should approve to ensure adequate funds are available. Mr. Speaker, in summary, and although there has been much debate on the question of the fourth judge publicly, we hope that the raising of this issue in this place and a joint collaborative approach adopted by the government and the opposition will serve as an example of how our continued cooperation in the question of matters that relate to the delivery of justice and access to justice. Our courts are many steps, the window to the common law world and interactions with business and commercial activity is often played out in our courtroom. And it is a good that is at the forefront of our minds alongside the important legal assistance reforms which demonstrates to many that there's a real requirement for flexibility in the resourcing of our courts. Mr. Speaker, in a number of criminal law jurisdictions, commercial courts have been established to deal with complex matters, and one day I'd like to see our courts being resourced to that level. Step by step, Mr. Speaker, we shall develop, but we must ensure that we do not take a step back in the level of judicial resourcing and expertise. Mr. Speaker, I was the member of the motion to
is there anyone or any of them wish to contribute to the debate on this item? The Honourable Norman Glenner.
Mr. Speaker, I'd just like to say that I'm glad that the Brexit context has been taken into account and acknowledged in this House. A context requiring prudent and sensible approach to the management of the public service, and I shall hereby support the motion.
The Honourable Member, call the member to reply.
Mr. Speaker, I think it is a very good thing that the whole House has unanimously supported the motion on the administration of justice. I think it shows that there is consensus on this issue. I just want to reply on a few matters that was raised by the Honourable Leader of the Opposition. He said that we should not rely solely on statistics, but I want to assure him that that is not the case. I think that statistics are important to the extent that they saw that there was a vertiginous drop of, I think, 60% from one year to the other in ordinary civil claims, and that from 2015 to 2017, the drop is still something like 40%. So although he's right to say that statistics cannot be the only yardstick, we agree with him completely, it is also good to say that it is a failure fact. That I've given in commitment to the honourable leaders and indeed to Parliament and therefore the wider community, that we will keep a close eye on the potential of complex commercial matters overwhelming the judiciary because there may be interlocutory applications, submission of large volumes of documentation, and that therefore, whereas there may be a lower number of civil cases, one or two civil cases could in effect overwhelm a judge more than a particular number of cases. So we have agreement across the floor of the House that it's not only the number, but also the complexity of any particular case, which is why we both said in the end of the motion that we will keep a particular eye specifically on complex commercial matters and also the impact on the legal assistance reforms. And I wish to say, in respect of the legal assistance reforms, that there has also been unanimity both from the former leader of the bar, which is the leader of the GSC, and also the Chief Justice during the course of the opening of the legal year, that the legal assistance reforms are currently formulated and put to the community will result in a significant increase in the access to justice, which is why I agree with him entirely that we could have made particular mention of any potential impact on judicial resources that may come from the positive consequence of having more members of our community having access to legal assistance. It is, and I really want to sound controversial in saying this, but it did so during the course of his contribution that it is said by government. With respect to him, it is not said by government, it is said by the entire civil society, it is also said by him, because the motion, which although presented in my name on behalf of the government, also enjoys the support. So all the matters raised in that motion, in fact, are agreed by all of us. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, I think it is fair to say that in respect of the practice instituted in 2011 of having fixed-term appointments, we are persuaded, and the honourable gentleman, at the conclusion of his contribution, also said that notwithstanding concerns about the potential impact on access to justice due to legal assistance reform, the possibility that the judicial council may be overwhelmed as a result of a particularly complex commercial case, as a result of interlocutory applications, and so on, that they are inclined to agree with the government that fixed-term appointments in a small jurisdiction such as ours are necessary. And he makes the point, and I wish to agree with him on this point only, he says that it is a question of funding, but with respect to him, for us, it is not a deal about funding. The contract clearly stipulated that the contracting of this particular fourth judge was expressly stipulated within for the short-term needs of the judiciary for a fixed period of time, so that both parties knew that there was a particular period of time in respect of which this fourth judge would be serving the community. And in that respect, it bears mentioning that the Honourable the Chief Justice himself, in the opening of the legal year, himself said that he did not have any legitimate expectation that the case would continue beyond the 3-year term, and it was always clear to him that the funding was meant to provide for the short-term needs of the judiciary, and that this was not a permanent increase to the judicial complement. As a result, Mr. Speaker, it's not that we're taking a step back, it is that we're returning to the usual complement of the Supreme Court, with comprising of one Chief Justice and two Chief Justices. And also, Mr. Speaker, for all of the reasons that I have mentioned, I commend the motion to the House.
And I propose the question, and I put the question in the terms of the motion proposed by the Honourable Minister for Health and Justice, Urban Funder. Aye. Out again. Carried.
Mr. Speaker, I'm conscious that there are other motions on the order paper, and I know that the Honourable Members have been giving indications that they don't wish to progress with them today. given that the time at which we find ourselves makes it impossible for the House to sit for much longer. And so, Mr. Speaker, I'm going to move that the House should now adjourn senior deals with this final thought. 37 years ago today, when Parliament and the Iberian Peninsula shot for fire, today in this Parliament, the only bullets flying are the words we throw at each other in democratic debate, Mr. Speaker. And long may it be so in this place, that we never have to commemorate anything like that, Mr. Speaker. And I move that the House should now adjourn senior deals.
The House will now adjourn senior deals.